This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. And one of the people that I often turn to, particularly when it comes to international issues or conflicts, one of the people whose opinion I have the greatest respect for, is sometimes just only thought of as, you know, the kind of in-your-face performance artist, activist that has made Code Pink so famous. But Medea Benjamin has written some just extraordinary, in-depth books and other writings on foreign policy. Her book, Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection, is must-reading for everybody in America. Her analysis and understanding of what's going on in Cuba caused me to join a Code Pink group, Louise and I, to visit Havana last year. We had a wonderful time. I strongly encourage you to check them out. And so, you know, as things are falling apart, as the wheels are coming off in Venezuela, we reached out to Medea to see if she was also an expert or an authority in that part of the world, and she has considerable knowledge. So I wanted to bring her on and talk about it. Medea Benjamin is with us. Medea, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom. Good to be on with you.
It's great to have you. And I should add, your Twitter handle is Medea, M-E-D-E-A, Benjamin. And people can, you know, Code Pink, obviously, CodePink.org or GlobalExchange.org. So we've got, you know, Chavez dies. Maduro was his kind of number two guy. He becomes president. Then he runs for election, gets reelected recently, just in the last few months, I guess. And the United States and Canada, which is the part that really had me scratching my head, and a number of other countries, including some European countries, are actually recognizing the guy who ran against him. This would be the equivalent of countries saying, after the election here in November 2016, you know, that's all very good that Donald Trump won the presidency, but Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes than he did, and there's considerable evidence of illegal voter suppression across, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio. More people were thrown off the voting rolls than voted for Trump in those states. And so we're going to recognize Hillary Clinton as president of the United States. You know, am I overstating this?
Well, maybe you should compare it to saying Nancy Pelosi should be head of state, because you can say our elections are quite fraudulent, and I would say with all the money in our elections, they're not very democratic. And then you could say that Donald Trump is incapable of running this government, and so Nancy Pelosi, we're going to declare her president. And some people might think, great, and I'm sure in Venezuela a lot of people are saying, great. But you know what? That's not the way things should work.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. So what's happened in Venezuela and what's going on? How did we get to there, to here, to this situation?
Well, it's important to recognize, Tom, that the economic situation is dire and that a lot of it has to be attributed to terrible mismanagement on the part of the government, corruption in the government. But we also have to recognize that a good part of it is also the economic sanctions. And when you hear the Trump administration talking about how much we care about the Venezuelan people, well, one good thing would be to lift the sanctions, because they really are affecting the lives of ordinary people who are really hurting.
That's really interesting. So Medea, one of the things that I learned years ago that just changed my thinking on all this is that there's basically two ways to produce inflation. One is to debase a currency, which is what Germany did in the early 30s, and happened in Zimbabwe, where the government intentionally devalues their own currency, and thus you have inflation. The other is to have a loss of an absolutely necessary part of your economy, typically a commodity. This is what happened in the United States in the 1970s, the Arab oil boycott, or embargo rather, and it made oil so scarce in the United States, the price of oil went, you know, to $100 a barrel. And the consequence of that was that produced inflation through the rest of the economy, because pretty much everything runs on oil in the United States. So, but with our, you know, with the, I think they're talking 10,000% inflation in Venezuela. Is that the result of a government decision to debase their currency, or is that the result of our embargo causing certain necessary pieces of the economy, food, for example, or it could even be something as unusual but still, you know, essential as toilet paper, that's just not available. And so the price is being driven up insanely, and that produces the inflation. What's going on? How's it happening?
Well, you hit the two of them, and then you implied the third, talking about the oil embargo. We have to also say that the price of oil went from over $100 a barrel till down to about 30. So the government lost a third of its revenue with the wild inflation of the oil market. Now, other countries have done a much better job at dealing with that. Venezuela had all these social programs that were initiated under Chavez that building 2 million new houses for people, allowing anybody who wanted to get free education all the way through college, free medical care, all of these things. And those expenses didn't go down, but when they had a third of the revenue that they had. And then with the U.S. sanctions, part of it is that Venezuela can't use the banking system. So its economy is totally crippled. And now the U.S. is saying that it's seizing Venezuelan assets and going to give them over to this parallel government that it created. That money, even separate from oil, the money that the Venezuelans had in England that was in gold reserves is now going to be given, they're saying, to this parallel government. According to the Venezuelans, I mean, who knows? We can't take those figures on face value. But they say that the U.S. economic sanctions in the last year alone has cost the economy $23 billion. Now, even if they exaggerated that, you know, and it was half of that, it's many billions of dollars, which is why for many Venezuelans, when Mike Pompeo said, we care so much about Venezuela, we're going to give them in humanitarian aid $20 million, and them, meaning not the present government, but this parallel government, many people in Venezuela said, wait a minute, you know, you cost us over $20 billion, and now you're going to give us 20 million crumbs. So the situation is dire for complex variety of reasons. The question really is how to move forward. And the way that the U.S. is proposing it now is really very, very scary. It seems to me like when you try to divide the military and they're going home to home of people in the military saying, abandon the government, go with us, when the U.S. is helping to orchestrate this whole thing from Washington, when they bring in people like Elliot Abrams, who is known for his support of right-wing death squads, this is all leading in one direction, and that is towards a civil war in Venezuela. You have such a polarized society, Tom, with at least 6 million people who support the government and then millions of others who don't support the government. The only way out of this situation that's not going to be a violent one is through negotiations, and that's why the proposals put forward by Mexico and Uruguay are so critical, and we should be saying, yes, let's pull our support and give it to those two countries that have a very good reputation in Latin America and say, we want them to be the mediators.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I understand also that now Russia's jumping into this act. Could, if civil war were to break out in Venezuela, could it be like the Vietnamese War, where essentially it's a proxy war, it's U.S. agents against Russian agents? And if so, what does that lead us to?
Imagine. I think the kind of horror that we're seeing in Syria could happen in Venezuela. And there are a number of people I've been talking to who hate the Maduro government, who are really worried about what they're calling the Syriaization of their country, because, as you say, Russia has a huge stake in Venezuela, as does China. Russia, because of the debt that Venezuela has, and Russia has lent them a massive amount of money, now owns 49.9% of Citgo, the Venezuelan oil company. And China has major, major investments and big debts that the Venezuelans owe. So there is a lot of economic interest at hand. Your listeners should know that Venezuela does have the world's largest oil reserves. So
even larger than Saudi Arabia?
Even larger than Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
So this is a This is a place that people are not going to wipe their hands easily and say, oh, we'll let the U.S. figure this out. No, you have big countries like China and Russia who are standing behind Maduro. You also have a division inside Latin America. When I was at the Organization of American States and got up at the end of Pompeo's talk to say, don't support a coup in Venezuela, there was a lot of applause in the room because half of the countries now at the Organization of American States are supporting Maduro and the other half are opposing him. So it's these splits are intense.
Wow. What can average Americans do? Call their senator at 202-224-3121 or their member of the House and say, here's my opinion or what? I mean, is there...
You know, we elect these people precisely, I mean, to deal with our issues here at home, but also to be there when there are international crises and be level-headed about these things. And so far, only 6 members of Congress, that's in the House and the Senate, so out of 535, only 6 of them have so far come out with statements either calling for negotiations or non-intervention. And so we really need to get on them. There's a letter that's going to be released today from the office of Congressman Ro Khanna and Pramila Jayapal from the Progressive Caucus, and we need to get a lot of Congress people to sign on to that. So I would say, yes, call your congressperson and say, we want to hear from you, whether it's signing on to a letter, a statement from your office, a tweet, whatever it is, saying that you believe in the principle of non-intervention.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. Extraordinary. Medea Benjamin, activist, co-founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange. Her new book, which you must have, if you have not read Medea's book, Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection, get it today. CodePink.org is the website. Medea Benjamin, at Medea, M-E-D-E-A-B-E-N-J-A-M-I-N, is her Twitter handle. Thanks so much, Medea.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Always Bye-bye. Great talking with you. I always learn something from you. I really appreciate it. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls. And I want to talk about the actual crisis that's happening in the United States right now that Donald Trump seems to want to ignore. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, refilling my water supply here. Bill in Sebastian, Florida. Hey, Bill, thanks for watching Free Speech. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom. Our withdrawal from the International Court, Criminal Court, has got me terribly upset. This paves the way for Elliot Abrams and the Negroponte's and the Boltons and the Pompeos to do as they please, as they've done what they please to these poor migrants that they have interned in America. They don't have any recourse, and it upsets me terribly that that's what Trump is paving the way for, just more abuse, more inhumanity. And it upsets me terribly, and I've been on the phone to all the congresspeople. I've called Ro Khanna's office, Jeremiah Paul's office, as well as the one running for president, what's her name?
Well, there's a bunch of them. Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Christian
Elizabeth
Gillibrand.
Warren's office as well. And to me, she seems to be the most stable, Elizabeth Warren. She seems to has examined this situation and...
Yeah. Her credentials as a progressive, much like Bernie's, are unimpeachable. They're absolutely solid. Bill, thank you. I agree with you. And withdrawing from the International Criminal Court, a huge mistake. Charles in Vancouver. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hi, Tom. In your conversation with Ms. Benjamin, you were asking at a point, how can we? What should citizens do? Should they call their senators? Should they call their congressmen? I would just point out that over the last several decades. Well, several decades ago, it took a long-distance phone call. It took pen and paper and a letter. Today, we have social media, particularly Twitter. A person can go into Twitter, and they can begin to type a name, and they'll come up with an address almost immediately. It's there that we can vote immediately on anything that comes over.
So you're saying we should be tweeting at our elected representatives?
It's a means of voting immediately on something that's going on, and to that end, what are Twitter metrics? They are tracking everything that they are tracking that data. And believe me, our representatives and senators, their staff are looking at the Twitter metrics.
Very interesting. So if you've got a message you want to get to Congressman Ro Khanna, for example, who was just with us for a whole hour taking people's calls, you just go into Twitter, type in the @ and R-O, and probably Ro Khanna will pop right up.
In most every instance that I go in there, within a few characters, I have the address of the person I want to communicate with.
Are you finding, Charles, that when you try to communicate with those people, that you're getting any kind of response?
Sometimes, yes, it generates a conversation, but I go back to what I said a moment ago. Twitter creates metrics.
Right.
And I guarantee you staff is following those metrics if they have an account for their representative or senator.
Absolutely. Have you tried this on Facebook or Instagram?
No, I don't use Facebook too much anymore with my understanding of what their CEO is doing and compromises of data and so forth. But Twitter, I'm satisfied with. Instagram, I haven't been on before.
Interesting. Charles, thanks for the call. Excellent point. And we should all be doing that. Great to hear from you, and thanks for watching us or for listening to us, however it was. I think you were on Free Speech TV. It's 24 minutes past the hour. 22 and a half minutes past the hour. We'll be right back with more of your calls and the news. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The real crisis in America, right? This Axios this morning put this out, and it's just, you know, very, very straightforward stuff. Donald Trump is saying, oh, you got all these brown people at the border, and they're coming to America, and they're doing murder and rape. Well, we don't have any reports of immigrant-caused crimes in the United States last week. If there were, you can bet that they would have showed up on Fox News with screaming breaking news headlines. Immigrant found to have shot so-and-so. Immigrant found to have raped so-and-so. You know, it happens periodically. It happens maybe once or twice a month. But this is just, it didn't happen last week, as far as anybody can tell. But this is what did happen, according to the Axios newsletter this morning. Sheriff's Department armored SWAT vehicle arrives at the SunTrust Bank in Sebring, Florida, where five young women were killed Wednesday. I'm not sure they were all young, but five women were killed Wednesday. Yesterday, authorities in Louisiana said they're searching for an armed, dangerous 21-year-old accused of killing his parents and three others in separate but related shootings. Yesterday, three men were shot and killed in southeast Washington, D.C., D.C. Police Chief Peter Newsom said in a separate incident earlier in the day, another homicide was reported in the Northeast. On Friday, a male St. Louis police officer was charged with involuntary manslaughter in the shooting death of a female officer in what was described as a game of Russian roulette. On Thursday, a gunman opened fire at a hotel bar near Penn State's main campus, killing two men and wounding a woman, broke into a stranger's house, fatally shot the 83-year-old homeowner, and then killed himself. Also on Thursday, authorities in Georgia are looking for a pair of 27-year-old gunmen who they say killed four people and wounded a man in a pair of shootings. On Wednesday, a man accused of fatally shooting five women at a small-town bank in Florida had dreamed of hurting classmates in high school and long been fascinated with killing. On Tuesday, a man is under arrest in Utah after police say he posted on Facebook about killing as many girls as I can see that same weekend that the women's marches were held around the U.S. This guy positioned himself or identified himself as an incel, as a an involuntarily celibate young man, 27 years old, never had sex with anybody. He's blaming women for this, and he's going to kill them. This is a real crisis. The incels, the guns, the killing, all of this stuff. This is an actual crisis. Guns in America right now are an actual crisis. You got 30,000, 34,000 people a year being shot in the United States. Half of all gun shootings are suicides. You know, fatal gun shootings are suicides in the United States. I mean, this is serious stuff that we need to be paying attention to right now. Anyhow, we'll pick up your calls on the other side of the news here at the bottom of the hour. There's an awful lot that we've been talking about from from Congressman Khanna having been with us for a full hour to our first hour talking about, you know, Howard Schultz, and is it time to say no to third-party candidates? I think it is.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
We'll be back with your calls and more of the news of the day right after this. Welcome back. Well, boy, talk about a crazy alert. This is our the crazy alert for the day. If you're 3 years old and you're out in freezing snow and rain and sleet, and it's coming down so hard and it's so cold and it's so bad that even the volunteer searchers and the professional searchers, the police and fire department looking for this three-year-old kid in the woods, say, we can't do this anymore. We've got to go home. We're going to die. How does a little kid, a three-year-old who's not dressed for the winter, stuck in the woods, survive two full days? I'm two full 24-hour periods, two nights in the woods. It actually happened. This is in North Carolina. This kid was lost in sub-zero temperatures, 3 years old. And when they finally, he came back, and when they found him, he said that, and it was in the low 20s Fahrenheit. I mean, it was well below freezing. For 2 days, this little kid says a bear took him in and used its body heat to keep him alive, apparently. It's amazing. And, yeah, there's lots of black bears in the area. You know, the Native Americans used to, in some tribes, used to refer to black bears, to bears, as grandfather or grandmother. Yeah, I think so. That's an amazing, crazy alert. Thank you, Shira. Howard in New York City. Hey, Howard, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi. I understand how to shut down a shutdown, but I don't understand what the government can do if he declares a national emergency. Can Congress do anything to stop that?
Yes, they can override him.
With what, just straight legislative votes?
That's correct. If Trump declares a national emergency, both the House and Senate can vote, and it's simple majority votes in both cases. Can vote to overrule his national emergency.
So if he vetoes it, they need a veto-proof margin. Is that right?
To the best of my knowledge, Howard. You know, we'll see how this plays out because it's looking. I mean, the reports are now that Nancy Pelosi is still saying there's no way he's getting a wall. Thanks, Howard. And he's saying, well, maybe I'll do a national emergency then. In fact, he's asked for the advice of his legal counsel on that. So we'll see what happens. Conrad in Ramona, California. Hey, Conrad, what's on your mind today?
The way we did before. That's got to be the first words out of every Democrat's or progressive's mouth when someone asks, how are we going to pay for free college? How are we going to pay for Social Security? How are we going to pay for our new freeway system? The way we did before.
Right. And we need our politicians when people like Howard Schultz and whatnot, when these very rich people or particularly these Republicans come out and go, oh, you know, if you raise taxes, I'm going to have to leave the country. I mean, this is just I'm one of the job creators, and I you can't do that. And this is through the 360 here, Sean. This is what FDR had to say about that.
A number of my friends who belong in the very high upper bracket have suggested to me on several occasions of late that if I am reelected president, they will have to move to some other nation because of high taxes here. Now, I will miss them very much.
There you go. And that's got to be our response, Conrad.
Yeah.
Thanks. Amen. A lot. Thanks a lot, Conrad, for the call. It's great to hear from you. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Yeah, and how are we paying for it now is the way I would respond to the last caller. I wanted to talk to Congressman O'Connor about, and you've had a guest on recently that says, tell personal stories. Okay, so let's talk about Medicare for All. My mom, week before last, had to go into the hospital for an emergency surgery. It wasn't serious. It was something she knew she had to have done, but it came to a crisis point, so she had to go and took an ambulance to the hospital. And while she was there, because she went in an ambulance, did not bring, of course, her medications with her. One of her medications, because she has asthma, and my mom is 90 years old, is now they're recommending a corticosteroid inhaler rather than the albuterol that is so common, the thing we those of us that have asthma carry in our pockets. Mm-hmm. But these steroid inhalers are very expensive. They're about $225. They have 120 puffs in them, and I believe me, that's 120, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Well, since she didn't have her inhaler with her, they kind of gave her one. They let her use one. Two puffs in the morning, two puffs at night. The nurse brought the inhaler, and they charged her by the puff.
Hmm. And it wasn't $2 a puff, was it?
No, it was. I think it was about $12.50 a puff. Because why? Because you have to have the nurse bring it to you. So the nurse brings it in the morning, take your two puffs, they write it down, they charge her for each puff. She was there 4 days, 16 puffs out of 120 is what she used, and then they threw the rest of it away.
Wow.
Because someone's already puffed on this.
That's
and
bizarre.
And Medicare got charged.
That's bizarre.
For throwing away 85% of a very expensive medication. This has got to change.
Yeah. I'm with you, Paul.
Medicare is going broke. Well, if you have laws that regulate drugs that way in favor of the drug companies, you throw away 85% of it. That's like if you buy a bottle of wine in the restaurant and they charge you by the glass, and whatever you don't drink, they throw the rest away. Come on.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Paul. And I don't know that this is a natural or legal or procedural extension of the Medicare Part D that Billy Townsend shepherded through Congress, which was a $600 billion subsidy to the big pharma industry, allowing them to spend a fortune on national television advertising now, so all we see are drug ads all the time. I don't know if there's a connection between the two or if this is merely kind of in the spirit of, but spot on. That stinks. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Dan in Waterloo, Canada. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to know if you had an opinion on why the media is pushing so hard on Democrats to give something on this wall. They're not pushing Republicans at all. And, like, if you saw the way they talked to Nancy Pelosi, they asked her, so what about the wall? And she said, had I not been clear on the wall?
Right.
And the reporter actually said, no. So she said, yes, I've been clear on the wall. There is no wall.
Right.
And it's just they're constantly pushing on them. What are you willing to give? What are you willing to give? Do you understand that?
Yeah, I do. And the media in this country has a solid Republican bias. It always has. I mean, look on any of the Sunday shows, for example, you'll see more Republicans than Democrats. You know, Democrats started seriously complaining about this in the early 2000s, particularly when the Republicans were all cranking up the enthusiasm to go to war with Iraq. And the network said, well, we've got to have more Republicans than Democrats on our news stories and on our Sunday shows because the Republicans are in power and people want to hear from who's in power. So then Obama becomes president for 8 years. And during those entire 8 years, every Sunday or virtually every Sunday, there were more Republicans than Democrats and very rarely any genuine progressives at all on the Sunday shows. And they asked the networks again, why do you have more Republicans than Democrats on? And the network said, well, because the Republicans are out of power. And so people need to hear from the group that's out of power. And, you know, they're the loyal opposition. Americans want to know what's going on. The bottom line is that these are giant corporations. These are multi-billion dollar corporations, Dan. And you know, with multimillionaires running them. You know, the guy who ran CBS, Les Moonves, who left with a $120 million golden parachute, it was finally taken away from him. But, I mean, this is how bizarre this guy is. He had two full-time employees at CBS, young women whose only job was to come to his office whenever he wanted, lock the door, and service him sexually at any random time throughout the day. Two full-time employees. This was their job. I mean, this is how bizarre the world of the media elite right now is. And, you know, it's just really unfortunate, but it's time to bring the Sherman Act to every industry in America and restore some genuine competition. Dan, thanks for the call. Michael in Oakland, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Tom, I'm really upset with Trump, so I'll say that first.
Okay.
But I'm really kind of confused with South America.
Mm-hmm.
South America is in the Americas, and this fool is talking about common sense and he's letting these people starve the same way he did with the people who were, who he just put out on strike, you know? Yeah. He made them strike. He made them not go to work, you know? He says common sense. This man has no sense. There's something wrong with this guy. We have to get him off of there. We have to get him out of there.
Would you rather have Mike Pence, Michael?
I beg your pardon?
Would you rather have Mike Pence?
Please. Mike Pence is up to his eyebrows in it, just like Sean says on Rachel.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to keep this all this perspective. I've been watching this for almost 3 years. You know, I broke out in hives just last month. I had to go to the hospital because the doctor said it was turn off the TV.
Wow.
You understand?
Well, maybe you should turn off the TV then, Michael. It's time to take up, jogging or something.
Tom. The man's on everything. He's infiltrating our minds every day, you know?
Yeah.
So I have to turn him off. But it's impossible to get away from this demon. He's the devil's disciple. That's who he is. He has no spirit at all. That's why he sits up there like he's some kind of king or something. It really pisses me off. Let me stop.
Yeah.
It pisses me off just to see this personality. He's a fraud.
Yeah.
He's a charlatan.
I get it, Michael. I agree with you. I agree with all that. And, you know, there's a certain kind of core psychological survival mechanism, and that is don't stick to him. You know, this is the old tar baby story from Uncle Remus. Do not stick to your opponent. And the way that you stick yourself to somebody is through hate, it's through obsession, it's through fear. We need to let go of all those things and just say, no, we're not going to embrace Donald Trump that way. Michael, thank you for the call. I get it. It's very upsetting to me as well. We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We're going to check in with Talk Media News in about 4 minutes. So stick around, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we will be checking in with Talk Media News to end the show in about 4 minutes here. Stick around, we'll be right back. And welcome back. Carlos in Ontario, Canada. Hey, Carlos, what's on your mind today?
Oh, good afternoon, Tom. Good afternoon. Okay, I'm going to make it quick, Tom, because this is my issue here. I truly believe in foreign intervention in any country whatsoever. Mm. But the situation in Venezuela is totally different. You have the Cuban intervention that nobody talk about it. You have the fact that Maduro on January 10 vacated his post as a president. Also, he had the fact that he put his own Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. He basically took away his political opponent on the last election. Mm-hmm. And now we got no other. I mean, the way I see it, I don't see any other solution. And
yeah,
I
it's kind of like, so what you're saying, Carlos, it's sort of like Daniel Ortega, who 40 years ago was arguably a good guy, but now has become just an absolute dictator in either Guatemala or Honduras. I forget which country.
Well,
and you're saying that basically Maduro has done the same thing. He's no longer the people's friend.
Well, no, Tom, he never was.
Okay.
In the case of Maduro, I mean, I give it to you. Chavez, yes, he was popular. Maduro never was. He was never popular.
Yeah. Carlos, it's a discussion that, you know, I don't know enough to essentially debate you on this topic, but I do know that, you know, Venezuela is a real mess, and hopefully we can work some of this stuff out. Carlos, thank you for the call. Don in Akron, Ohio, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Don, what's up?
Well, I have a minor disagreement with you. Usually I think you're right on, but this is about the third party
mm-hmm.
issue. I think back in the 1920s, there was a precedent for third parties actually being largely responsible for Roosevelt's policies.
You're talking about the Bull Moose Party?
Well,
Teddy Roosevelt's activities back in the 19-teens?
No, not Teddy, but Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
What am I missing?
Well, there were a couple of socialist parties. There were labor unions. There was Communist Party. There were what we would today call the left was quite strong. And because of the pressure, that these groups and political parties pushed on to threaten, actually, Roosevelt with, I think, caused him to move in the direction that he took. I gather this from listening to Dr. Richard Wolff, mm-hmm. who I think is pretty accurate on most things. And I think the strategy that we could learn from it is that third parties, Greens, Socialists, whatever you want to call them, progressive parties could support Democratic candidates.
Well, this is the point I made earlier on, was that sometimes third parties actually move the conversation, and sometimes they can be very useful. And in New York State, which is where Roosevelt was, that was his power base, that's particularly true because they have fusion voting. So you can vote on the liberal ticket in New York and for a Democrat, for a Democratic candidate. But, that said, I don't see where a third party run by Howard Schultz is going to help anybody.
Well, no, not a billionaire. No, I'm thinking more someone like Cortez who are. But the thing is, if there is not a way to move the Democrats to a progressive direction, I think they should very conspicuously.
Yeah, well, I think the Democrats are being moved within the party by progressives like Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders. Don, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour. And on the line with us is Bob Ney, this report, Talk Media News Report, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and Ellen Ratner's new book, Loving What You Do. On the line with us, Congressman Bob Ney, the author of Sideswiped, the definitive insight into how D.C. really works. Bob, welcome back to the program. What's going on in the world today?
Well, thank you, Tom. Of course, the shutdown ended temporarily for now, as we all know by now. And I think it was a telling moment when Senator Schumer, who, of course, is the minority leader of the Senate, received more votes than the president's measure. And that should have, of course, told the White House that they had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And now they'll be trying to figure out what else on earth they will do as the deadline approaches for the 15th. Now, there is going to be a type of, I'll call it a conference committee, House and Senate members from both sides of the aisle, and as I understand it, they're going to take some testimony on border security, and then they will be preparing basically for what happens after the 15th, because it just went a couple of weeks, and then they're going to have to do something else.
Right.
So there'll be some intense.
In other words, this is like in anticipation of Trump trying to shut the government down again if he throws another tantrum around his wall.
Correct.
Wow.
And so they're doing, it's really, Tom, it's basically a sort of unusual move because they have passed a measure over which he has signed, and then it reopens the government temporarily instead of going all the way to October the 1st, which would normally be what normally happens. It goes to February 15th, and they are, I guess, anticipating, of course, that by the 15th, before that, they have to have some type of bill, the Congress does.
Right.
And so they're going to hold hearings on border security.
Yeah, well, that's the normal legitimate process, and a good thing that they're doing it. Bob, my understanding is that if Trump declares a state of national emergency and then tries to move, army money around, for example, to put it down on the wall, that Congress, both the House and the Senate, have the ability with a simple majority vote to declare that the state of emergency no longer exists. Am I right about that? And if so, is there a discussion going on about what to do and in that context?
Now, there is one problem with it. Of the 100 and, if I'm doing this from memory, Tom, so of the 136 different avenues he potentially could take to acquire money, mm-hmm. there are, where he really needs to acquire money, the 16 different ways they could step in and say, no, you can't do that. There are some other avenues he could use where they technically could still step in, but would have probably not as much authority to do it.
They being Congress.
Yes, they being Congress. Let me give you one example. He can declare an emergency, and then he can begin to take up to $80 million from a Pentagon fund to begin the construction of, quote, the wall, the barrier, or, the papier-mâché, whatever they're going to do.
Yeah.
And the Congress really, it could take some action, but wouldn't have as much legitimacy as if he went another route and began to take monies from other agencies. So, yes, you're right that they can step in and undo it. There are some tricks up his sleeve he could use, but, again, it would be only $80 million, mm-hmm. which is not enough to even probably do the design of the wall, right? So he would have to seek some other sources, and, yes, they could step in and do something. Here's one other problem he has now. If he declares an emergency and the Congress, let's say they don't have the votes in the Senate to do anything about it, okay, mm-hmm. and he declares an emergency, you know, federal judges in making decisions do read information that they acquire, you know, because obviously people fighting this would bring information. And if he declared that emergency and that night in the Oval Office said national emergency, why has he waited this amount of time to do it? So, therefore, he's taken away his legitimacy by even waiting to the point that we're speaking right now. If it was an emergency, why didn't he do it 5 weeks ago,
yeah.
6 weeks ago?
There's an old cliche in business, Bob, that as a director or a CEO or a manager, it's really important to know the difference between important and urgent. Mm-hmm. Some things are important but not urgent. Other things are urgent but really not all that important. And Trump has been portraying this wall, this border crisis in quotes, as both important and urgent. Whereas I think it is important that we talk about, you know, border security and we talk about immigration right. in general. But the urgency, I mean, he's just trying to trump this up, you know, pun intended.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so he's hurt himself in actually that move now. It should have been done, you know, 5 weeks ago.
Right.
There is one other thing where he's really hurt himself, which I agree with you that this would probably force the Republicans to actually step in and undo something he's going to do, because he has now offset the entire boost from his point of view, or Republican point of view, from the Trump tax cuts. That's mm-hmm. what he's done. So according to their own projections, the White House's own projections, the government shutdown that just ended has already eroded any impact of tax reform and spending increases that he signed in 2017.
Right.
Now, this is coming from the council, the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, Kevin Hassett, and he said himself that the shutdown reduces quarterly annualized economic growth by 0.13 percentage points for every week it lasts.
So kiss your sugar high goodbye.
Right, and this is from their side. This isn't coming from a Democratic side. So if he does this again towards February 15th, he's going to have a knee-jerk reaction, obviously, from the Republicans who are trying to run on great benefits.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, reporter with Talk Media News. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Tom.
Always great talking with you. I always learn something from Bob, too. It's extraordinary. Well, thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, for more of the news and events of the day. In the meantime, please know, not only is there no room for despair here, but we've got to get active. The future of our republic depends, in part, on you showing up to participate. So please, get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.